We are going to open now with Mark arguing in favor of the resolution. And once again, it is resolved that the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria should be transformed to become the Global Fund for Health. Mark,
thanks, welcome. And thanks to CSIS for inviting me. And it's great to be on stage with Julian. I have to have a caveat. I have a really bad cold, which puts me at a distinct disadvantage because I'm not normally coherent, and I'm even less coherent. Julian could run circles around me even if I were healthy, but we'll do our best. I actually think the overriding question and the starting point should be what do we want global health architecture to look like? Not start with what does it look like. Let's start with what we want it to look like and see if we can have a vision and achieve that vision. And to do that, I think we need to kind of look at the arc of development and global health, where we've come from, where we are today, and where we want to go. So just starting the latter part of the 20th century, development and global health were largely driven by the Cold War and post-colonial guilt. Sadly, that's where most development came from. As we moved into the 21st century, we saw nothing short of a revolution, a philosophical revolution in terms of what development was about, and that was really enshrined in the Monterey Consensus, the Paris Declaration, and the Accra Accord. And if you distill those down, a couple of key principles, philosophical foundations were there. The most important was country ownership, that we had to move away from the paternalistic approach of post-colonial guilt and the Cold War to full country ownership. And that in order to achieve country ownership, we needed good governance, a results-based approach, all sectors being engaged, that it's not just about public sectors, but all sectors need to be involved. And beneath that, which we're not going to talk that much about, that economic growth is the ultimate engine of development, that everything we do in global health and other areas are in many senses a band-aid. That was revolutionary from where we were in development. And then we had the Millennium Development Goals, which set a framework for development, which included health. The important thing is that we didn't just have a philosophical change. There are a lot of philosophical changes that just sit on shelves. We actually had a massive increase in resources. And most of that was for health. And in many ways, the first decade of the 21st century was the decade of global health, a radical change in taking those principles, those philosophies, and trying to apply them, including with the creation of new institutions. Most of that money was dedicated to disease-specific programs. And they've done a great deal of good. And I don't think we need to go into the many millions of people who are alive today because of disease-specific programs. Many, many tens of millions who will not have disease because of disease-specific programs. So they've done extraordinary good. They've also, in many ways, restored faith in development by setting large dollar amounts for goals and achieving them. We moved from a sense of development, which was just a bunch of money floating around with nothing to show for it, to a real belief that you could dedicate large amounts of money, set targets, and achieve results. And in many ways, the new mantra of results-based development is a direct derivative of disease-specific programs. So as such, disease-specific programs were an essential step in the evolution of development. It's an essential movement in the arc of development. And in many ways, it was an evolutionary jump. It wasn't just a slow evolution. It was a radical change. And I believe we could not have done integrated programming 10 years ago. There would not have been the support for it. But disease-specific programs have also revealed fault lines in global health and, in fact, in development. In today's jargon, they taught us some lessons. There are a lot of lessons learned. One is that we have very weak delivery systems. As people were pushing radically expanded health programs for HIV or malaria or neglected tropical diseases, we found that the systems were not strong enough to support them in a very obvious way. The second piece, perhaps one of the most important pieces, which we all always knew, is that we had silos in funding that led to silos in delivery, and that the money led to the way development was done. Now, silos aren't optimal for a couple of reasons. They are not optimal in terms of public health. A mosquito really doesn't care if it bites an HIV-positive or an HIV-negative person. A pregnant woman who sleeps under a bed net or receives antiretroviral therapy during pregnancy but dies during childbirth is no better off, nor is her child, nor is her family, nor is her community, than if she never received malaria prophylaxis or antiretroviral therapy. a child who is born to an mother who receives antiretroviral therapy and therefore has a mother but never gets immunized, treatment for neglected tropical diseases, is not going to grow, is probably not going to be awake at school and won't become educated, and then you have a cycle of underdevelopment, of not integrated and not good health. But it also, silos also are extraordinarily inefficient and duplicative. And this is something we have seen with clarity because of disease-specific programs. We really didn't, we knew it was there, but we didn't see it so much when you had a bunch of pilot programs scattered all over the place. Once you had national scale-up of large programs for disease-specific interventions, it became crystal clear what the duplication and inefficiencies were. In many ways, it's because of disease-specific programs that we can actually talk about weak health systems and silos, as Susan said. The simple fact, in my own view, is that we could be doing 3 to 4 times more, which means we could be saving 3 to 4 times more lives today and every day because of the way we do development. If we did development differently, just with the money we have today, we could be saving and lifting up 3 to 4 times more lives. Another key lesson learned in my view, and this I've grown to feel very strongly about, is that when an organization combines the provision of technical assistance or technical support with program dollars, you fundamentally undermine that key principle of country ownership. The fact of the matter is that there are lots of technical ways to do things. There are lots of partners out there. When you're providing technical support and providing program dollars, where do you think the program dollars are going to go if you're also providing the technical support? It's going to go to the areas that you provided the technical support for. And so by combining technical support and program dollars, we fundamentally prevent true country ownership. We fundamentally prevent achieving those goals of a new era in development. The last lesson learned I think we have learned is that we do need the current bilateral and multilaterals. There are problems with them, but there are key things they do. Guidelines, standards, technical support, accountability, things that financing institutions cannot and should not do and that we need global institutions to do. So accepting the upsides and downsides of disease-specific programs, why don't we consider for a moment what the next genetic leap should be, what the next move along the arc of development should be, given what we've learned, and especially in the past decade. Before I lay out a few options, I want to make clear that what I'm talking about is external financing. There's an awful lot of internal financing that goes on, and we don't pay enough attention to that. But the fact of the matter is that large amounts of external financing can drive good behavior towards global health, or it can drive bad behavior towards global health. And right now, the large amounts of external financing are driving countries that want to have integrated approaches to health because they understand the principles we just talked about to do siloed programs because that's how the money is provided. So there's a lot that's important in internal financing, but we're just talking about external financing for now. So a couple of options. One is better coordination. It's a good approach. We've been doing this for, 15 years, lots of efforts, lots of good efforts. We actually are far more coordinated today than we were 10 years ago, but it's not enough. And it's my deeply held fundamental belief that our current multilateral and bilateral structures are actually not genetically capable of integration. Virtually every incentive system built into them is against integration. Now, that's not a criticism of the institutions. They were created for a purpose. Each organization was created to achieve a goal or achieve some purpose. They were staffed that way. The culture and structure was created that way. That's what happened. That's how they were built. That's not a criticism of them. It's just we've grown beyond that. And it's certainly not a criticism of the people, because our development organizations are filled with some of the most talented, creative, exceptional people you will ever run across. But they're stuck in these cultures and structures that limits their ability to grow the way they should. So another option is to transform what we are doing and develop a mechanism for external financing that leads to country ownership, and that supports and only supports integrated country national health plans. Now, not everything's going to be integrated. Some stuff should not be integrated, but a lot should be, and a plan should be put together at the national level that tells whether or not you're integrating, how you're integrating, why you are not. And that financing mechanism should be completely separated from technical support. so that you don't have that impediment to country ownership. Now, there are a couple ways to get there. One is to create something new. I'm not going to go into the 50,000 reasons why that's a bad idea, especially right now in our financial situation. We can talk about that later if anyone wants to. What are the options from what's out there today? Transforming the Global Fund is one of them. And I want to make clear I'm talking about transforming the Global Fund, not expanding its mandate. The fund as it exists today could not do what I am suggesting. It would need fundamental change in many of its structures and many of its approaches. It needs to be transformed. But the Global Fund is the only institution out there that was created specifically to respond to those principles of the Monterey Consensus, the Paris Accord, and our Paris Declaration and the Accra Accord. It was created for country ownership, results-based, all sectors engaged, and good governance. Another possibility, and this is the one I actually favor, is better alignment between the Global Fund, the World Bank, and other institutions. And the way I would suggest we do this is to have one review panel for integrated national health strategies that crosses the different organizations, that is composed of the different organizations, that is separate from technical support, which would be provided by multilaterals, bilaterals, even from those institutions, but there would be a clear wall between the financing institution and the technical support. Countries would request technical support when they want it, either as they're creating an application, during the application process, or after they get questions on the application. But it's their plan, it's their request, it's their ask, it's country-driven technical support, not coming from someone else. And then you'd have to have a structure where you'd go through the governance boards. So I don't have any time left, actually, so I'm going to kind of end there. But all I want to say is that we have had these evolutionary changes, and what I'm proposing is another evolutionary change. I also want to make it clear that this is the next step. I would expect to have something completely new in 10 to 15 years. As countries grow and expand, develop economically, develop better mechanisms and stronger accountability mechanisms, we should transform this mechanism. How we require reporting should depend on performance. A country that's performing well should almost have a pass-through in terms of grant processes and other approaches. But we have to change what we're doing. And to come back to the initial question, if we could create an approach to global health and architecture, would we create what we have today? And I don't think there's any question the answer is no. So rather than fitting a vision into our current structures, why don't we fit our current structures or recreate our structures to fit a vision that will lead to integrated health, that will lift up and save as many lives as possible? And in this moment in history, which don't come often, we have the opportunity to do that. So with so many lives at stake, I think it's a moral imperative that we act now.
Great. Thank you, Mark. I think we're in an unusual position here. I just want to test this out. It seems as if we have a resolution that the Global Fund be transformed to the Global Fund for Health that nobody is in favor of on this panel.
No, I am in favor of it.
Because you said that your preferred option was better alignment between the existing Global Fund and the World Bank and other institutions.
I should have clarified.
Okay.
It would be alignment with a transformed Global Fund so that the Global Fund is receptive to and is one of the principal, if not the principal, organization for an integrated approach to global health. You just have different funding streams for it. But
okay.
You would still have to transform. The Global Fund today could not serve that function.
Okay, so it's a two-step procedure.
Two-step.
Transform the Global Fund and then better align. Okay, good. Thank you for clarifying that. I was getting worried that I was going to have to argue for the resolution because no one else would. All right, so with the potential of the big, hairy global juggernaut fund in the offing, if we were to go Mark's route, let's turn over now to Julian and ask you to argue your statement in the negative on the resolution.
Thank you very much. Well, I'm almost in complete agreement with Mark on the diagnosis. There are clearly fault lines in delivering healthcare in silos, and patients clearly need integrated services which respond to a wide variety of needs. We've all seen the result: freestanding single disease clinics which don't serve local needs well, duplication of projects with existing facilities or which steal scarce health workers, cars lined up in Ministry of Health garages which can only be used for a single project. That's one of my favorites. And there's often let me say, a mismatch between the burden of disease and the flow of development assistance for health, which results in a clear mismatch between supply and demand. And simple process, just as an example, simple processes such as hand washing are vastly more cost-effective than vaccinations against diarrheal disease, but hand washing gets little attention and no funding. And this is an example of the siloed approach. So I have no disagreement on that. I also agree that I think we can get far more health for the money by improved harmonization, by different practices, we have to do better. I mean, the stories of the 650-plus health indicators demanded of the Rwandans, or the multiple audit systems which Ethiopia has to maintain to meet the mutually inconsistent financial management demands of the donors, these are all famous, and the diagnosis is clear. But having done this diagnosis and recognizing the efforts made to improve harmonization, does the expansion of the Global Fund into a super global fund for health make sense? Will that proposed cure help alleviate the problem, or might it make it worse? Just a few background facts. We've seen a huge expansion from 5 to about 22 billion in about 17 years. But actually, this vastly underestimates the real spending on the health MDGs, because, for example, probably there's been 8 or 10 billion has been spent in the last decade alone on infrastructure related to health, such as water supply and sanitation. And the World Bank estimates that 175 million people have access to clean water. As a result, those numbers don't tend to get into this. And one really crucial question is, how do you integrate this stuff into the global health agenda? Because health is much bigger than, as we know, ministries of health. And, you know, a recent Lancet article attributes much of the decline in maternal mortality in Africa to improved education of girls, another example of the multisectoral nature of this. Mark mentioned, but I think needs much more elucidation, is this issue that actually development assistance for health only comprises a small fraction of health spending, maybe 20% in Africa, 3% in South Asia. So we've got to be careful. What happens to the other 80%, and how does that get integrated into this debate? And I want to make another point. Over 50% of health spending in low-income countries is private. And more than 50% of health providers are non-government. So again, we have to be very careful in thinking about new mechanisms, that we really this time don't ignore these crucial players who have tended to be completely ignored in the past. Look at WHO. It still doesn't recognize the private sector. See, I can speak now. I don't work for the World Bank. Other point I want to make. The US is by far and away the largest contributor to development assistance for health. And private philanthropy in the US is a huge contributor. It's 30%. And I don't need to tell you which. There's one big behemoth out there, which is 50% of that. So a question is, are they going to integrate themselves and put all their money into this global health fund? Probably not. Anyway, back to the discussion. Why do I think that expanding the global fund might not work? 8 basic reasons. Mark argues that the solution to the problems created by the current fragmented and uncoordinated system is to expand the global health fund into a large, what I'm calling global quasi-funding monopoly, while others do the design, monitoring, and TA, avoiding the conflict of interest whereby the Global Fund would be simultaneously designer, financier, and monitor of its own funded programs. But I want to point out this is how the Global Fund was originally designed, to be a lean funding organization relying on others to do the implementation and evaluation. It now has over 600 and counting staff sitting in one of the most expensive cities in the world. What happened? The stakeholders began to insist on in-house expertise and specialization, not just in the 3 diseases, but in supporting issues such as gender, financial management, procurement, et cetera, et cetera. I would argue that expanding the functions of the currently structured Global Fund will simply create a vastly bigger bureaucracy. It is unrealistic to think that an expanded Global Fund will simply delegate all the specialized functions in maternal and child health, let alone nutrition, water supply, and so on, to other agencies, any more than it has been able to delegate these in the past. The conflict of interest problem, already severe, could get much worse. Second, even if it could become more streamlined and efficient, and I'll argue in a minute that I think that's unlikely, why would a monopoly be a good thing? Are monopolies generally efficient, and do they meet client needs? We should not assume that health is so different from any other economic and social sectors, and I propose that some competition is actually a good thing. competition of ideas, innovation, financing, procurement, etc. Government needs agencies which are highly responsive to client needs. I entirely agree with Mark. We need to be supporting country plans. But monopolies, be they global health monopolies or others, are not famous for stimulating innovation, responsiveness, or cost effectiveness. Third, would this global policy be feasible? I personally can't imagine that the large bilateral donors, the large philanthropic organizations, or the multilateral banks will give up their own grant-making or lending services to accommodate the expanded global fund. As Mark notes, the worst possible solution is an expanded mandate without requisite funding. But this is a serious danger. Would a private philanthropy interested in developing new vaccines simply hand over its resources to the expanded global fund? Put simply, how would the GEF manage research and development? It's likely that the unfunded mandate would result in increased global fund intervention, participation in international meetings, etc., without any serious funding, expertise, or authority. Next point. As I noted above, many health outcomes are not necessarily linked to health-specific investments. You know, we can think of water supply, girls' education, road traffic safety. Road accidents kill huge numbers of people in poor countries. Thus, if the Global Fund would handle the health-related MDGs generically, it would have to duplicate many of the functions of other agencies, including the multilateral development banks. But as I suggested, these agencies would not stop their own lending and grant-making for non-health-related issues such as infrastructure, and so there could be more, not less, fragmentation. Does the Global Fund have the expertise to seek financing for health-related infrastructure, and should it? Next point. Similarly, since so much of health spending is private, out of pocket, which we know is the worst option for the poor, there's a huge need to introduce effective community and national health insurance systems and to ensure that these systems are linked to the broader financial sector. Again, what would be the benefit of duplicating existing financial institutions and expertise? In summary, to fulfill its new mandate, the new Global Fund would need to become a multi-sectoral organization, in essence mimicking what the multilateral development banks do now. Now, even if all this were a good idea, it would require, as Mark notes, a radical change in the governance of the Global Fund. Mark acknowledges this in his paper, which I should acknowledge is a great paper, but skates over what I think are the formidable challenges. The good news about the current Global Fund is that it is representative of many health actors, civil society, governments, private sector, philanthropy, etc. And it can achieve a degree of consensus and ownership as a result. However, that is being achieved at a cost. Predictably, the Global Fund has evolved into a large and cumbersome bureaucracy with a complex governance system. As in all international bodies, different interest groups lobby hard. Decision-making can be painfully slow. Recipients complain about lengthy and complex disbursement procedures. Each Global Fund round can gobble up an enormous amount of ministerial time and attention. Next week's MDG summit will hopefully release some new pledges for global health, but it would take a superb optimist to believe that there will be anything like the $22 to $45 billion per annum needed. Pressure to maintain or increase funding for the Global Fund's current portfolio will undoubtedly be severe and somewhat justified. And under these circumstances, placing all this new money into the Global Fund would be unlikely to ensure equitable funding for non-infectious diseases. Again, as Mark has noted, the end result will probably be an expanded mandate with few additional resources. Finally, let me look at the effectiveness issue. Mark argues correctly that the Global Fund has been a very effective mechanism to save lives. And if you look at their website, by their count, the Global Fund has invested over $19 billion to save about 5.7 million lives since the start of its operations. No bad feat. But how have other agencies done? That's difficult to know, because other agencies haven't used the Global Fund methodology to evaluate their own systems, and thus we don't really have any value for money comparisons. I would argue that that would be an essential prerequisite for this debate. I do know that the World Bank will soon publish its own estimates of lives saved through its multi-sectoral investments using the Global Fund methodology. And I understand that their preliminary estimates suggest that more than 30 million lives have been saved over the same period using a combination of investments valued at $21 billion. This is not to make a direct comparison. What it strongly suggests is that we need to evaluate the impact of these different funding modalities using common criteria across agencies to see how we are doing. And second, that diversity of approaches may actually be highly beneficial. We may get more bang for the buck from having different approaches. I'll stop there because we'll have a chance to sum up with possibly to talk about some alternatives.